Hi, I'm Jay Novacek of the Dallas Cowboys.
With the Colonel on the radio.
Here comes the Colonel.
That silly broad, she'll laugh at anything, won't she? I can't say anything funny about Jay Novacek. I do remember the lunch, though. It was really great. That's when the Cowboys were winning Super Bowls. Ooh. Well, I talked to my friends in Boston this morning, and they're pretty happy with winning the Super Bowl. I said, you getting more snow? I said, yeah, another foot of snow coming in on top of the 2 or 3 feet they have already, and they have terrible rumor where they're going to put it all. But he said, at least we won the Super Bowl. Well, anyway, I presume the snow is going to be gone by the time the Homeland Security Technology Conference comes around the middle of April. But in Boston, of course, one never knows. All right, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. In just a minute, we're going to get back to our encore interview with the late, great Stephen Snyder, who is a fascinating study that he's done since the 1970s on global warming. But first, let's step over here to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set. For today's query. Get around the coin jar a little bit. There we go.
Welcome to the Fountain of Useless Information. How can I help you?
Yes, of course. We've thrown in the coins and we have awakened the spirit of the fountain. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. Here's one that'll be an easy one for you. What's the largest island within the Indian Ocean? The Indian Ocean. What's the largest island in the Indian Ocean?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell me.
Aha! I knew this one wouldn't stump you. The largest island in the Indian Ocean? If you said Kuwait, you're wrong. Of course it's not Kuwait. Yes, it's Madagascar. That was an easy one. Everybody knows that one. All right. Back to our program. Well, what we know for sure, do we really know for sure that the Earth is heating up in a way that is unusual, not the way it's done over the millennia, but I mean a really dramatic heating we're going through right now? Is that really happening?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Colonel. Let me start with what we know for sure and work down to what's more speculative, and then I'll come back and make certain that I tie up that in the way you asked me the question.
Okay.
We know for sure from the thermometers of the world and from the fact that 95% of the mountain glaciers are melting and the Arctic sea ice is dramatically thinner than it was 25 years ago, and Greenland is melting on its sides much faster than it's accumulating ice on the top, and those plants and animals that have been measured to be changing, the roses are blooming a little earlier in your grandmother's backyard, and birds are coming back a little earlier in migration. So IPCC said, and I agree with it, that it's unequivocal that at least in the last 100 to 150 years, the Earth is warming. But the big question there, so that's well established, essentially beyond a doubt. The tough question is how much of that is due to Ma Earth and how much of that is due to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that question we can't answer directly by data because Ma Earth, being the perverse lady she is, she just gives us what happens. She doesn't tell us how much is her and how much is us. So what we do is we now have to construct a theory based upon data of how the world works. So we look at all the data we can that we've gathered over the last couple of hundred years about the atmosphere and all the data we can about the oceans and about the ecosystems and the chemistry. And we codify that data, given our knowledge of physics and chemistry and biology, into rules. These are mathematical statements of how we think the system works. And, of course, the word that we call for this virtual reality is a model. So the models are run on computers. Now the question is, are the models any damn good? Well, in order to figure that out, you try things with them. You let the model predict June versus January, and lo and behold, it makes June in the Northern Hemisphere about right, 15 degrees warmer than January. If it didn't do that, we'd throw it in the garbage. It has the tropics warmer than the poles. It has the deserts drier than the forests, and you know, in the middle of continents having extreme climates when the middle of oceans don't. If they didn't do that, they'd be crap. But the problem is, the future is going to be driven not just by the processes of the past, that is, changes in a little bit of changes in the energy output of the sun and volcanic eruptions or so, dust in the stratosphere, plus the Earth's orbit around the sun. Those we all know, and we put them in our models, and the models actually do a fairly good job of reproducing what happened. But in the future, we're going to have a very significant addition of greenhouse gases and hazes and land use changes. That's never happened in the past at the rate and in the way it's happening now. So there is no data on the future, so we have no choice but to use the models. So what we do is we test the models. We do what we call fingerprints. That is, we'll say, okay, model, what should have happened if human activities were part of the story? And the model predicts that because of ozone depletion and greenhouse gases, that the stratosphere, that's up about 10, 20 miles up, should cool and the lower atmosphere and the surface should warm. If the sun did it, which I'm sorry to say is a routine explanation in the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal without any other points of view, then what would have happened is it would have warmed the stratosphere, the middle of the lower atmosphere, and the surface. That's not what happened. Stratosphere cooled, lower atmosphere warm, just like the model said. That's a fingerprint that human activities did it. Is that definitive? No, because supposing we were completely ignorant, we knew nothing, then there's a 50% chance the stratosphere warms, a 50% chance it cools, 50% chance the surface warms, right? 50% chance it cools. I'm talking about the last 50 years. So there's a 25% chance we got it right for the, you know, by luck. So that's not enough of a fingerprint. What else do? We ask the models, okay, models, predict for us what happens in the relative warming of low-latitude continents, high-latitude continents. Predicts low latitudes warm up less than high latitudes. Did that happen in the last 50 years? Yes. Again, 25% chance that it's a fluke. How about, what else does it predict? It predicts night warms up more than day. Did that happen? Yes. Another 25% chance. Now you see we got three of them?
Mm-hmm.
That's not 25% anymore. That's 25% times 25% times 25%. It's much more likely than 9 out of 10 that in the last 50 years, humans are part of the recent warming. That's how it's done. It's done by doing these so-called fingerprints, and there are three or four more of them. They all line up. So the scientific community considered it to be, and the words they used were very likely in our language means more than 9 out of 10, that humans are part of the story, or at least the majority of the story, but only in the last 50 years. Nobody claimed anything before that. Now, your question was, it's warmed up before. Absolutely. It was warmer 5,000 to 9,000 years ago, especially in the desert areas and in the middle of continents, than it is now. And some people, it was much warmer in the whole planet 125,000 years ago, 1.5 degrees Celsius, like 2-3 Fahrenheit. And people have said to me, well, it's been warmer before, therefore this is just natural. Well, the trouble is, there's no therefore there. I'll give you an analogy. 3 years ago, I had this horrible flu over Christmas. Killed my whole vacation. It was called the norovirus. You ever have that? That stomach?
Yeah,
I had 102 for 3 days.
Mm.
If every global warming in the history of the planet were all the same, all natural, all due to the same cause, then that logic says that every time I have a fever, it's always due to the same thing. So the next time I have 102 for 3 days, it's got to be the norovirus by that logic, right? Couldn't be respiratory, kidney, malaria, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do in science is we try to figure out why do we have a fever? Why did the planet change? And we know what happened 5,000 to 9,000 years ago. The Earth was tilted more in its orbit, therefore more sunlight came into the high latitudes in the summer than now, and in fact the very same computer models that we use to project the 21st century predicted what actually happened in paleoclimate. So not only do the events of the past not refute the present, they in fact support the argument. And that's what the scientific community does. Now, this is never reported because every time I tell reporters, why don't you cover this, they say it's too many numbers, the story's too complex. So people are getting these snippets of information from the deep ecology groups only telling you the well-established, and the enterprise institutes and the coal industry only telling you the speculative part. This is not a problem that's bipolar. You know, it's not Democrats versus Republicans equal status. Scientists will argue there's multiple potential outcomes. The two lowest probability ones are the end of the world and good for you, the ones that get all the battle in public, and everything in between is more likely, and we spend most of our time trying to figure out the relative credibility of each of those arguments. And unfortunately, in the media debate, which is based on an advocacy model, they jump to the extremes. No wonder people are confused. I can't blame them.
Well, I have to ask you, you know, this talk about a global problem, but isn't there evidence that as the North Pole is warming, that the South Pole is actually getting colder, and that makes it not a global problem?
That's not true either. There's been several studies recently done. The reason that the South Pole was uncertain is because there are so few thermometers there that it was very difficult to put them together into a coherent and meaningful average. Whereas in the north, where most of us live, we have so many thermometers that the signal is very clear. You know, it's what we call a sampling error. If you don't have very many samples, you can't tell what you're measuring. Something may be going on. However, very recently, there have been long-term analyses of those thermometers that existed, ship tracks, and other things, and they have now concluded that although parts of Antarctica are cooling, just as the middle of the higher northern Atlantic Ocean is not warming up very much, there are always going to be parts of the Earth that are exceptions, the bulk of the Antarctic is warming slightly. By the way, the models predict the Antarctic warms much slower than the Arctic because of the massiveness of the continent and the fact that it's surrounded entirely by ocean, which has much, much longer thermal lag. So the fact that Antarctica is slow is not only expected, it's validating the theory rather than invalidating the theory, because it's what was predicted. But the most recent studies, which have now been published in peer-reviewed journals, we're not talking about op-eds and blogs, which carry no credibility, says that even the Antarctic is warming, but not all of it, just on average a little bit. However, the most warm place in the world, unfortunately, is on the peninsula on West Antarctic that sticks out in the ocean. And the reason I said unfortunately is that's where there's very rapid change in ice, which affects sea level. So it's not an exception. When somebody says, oh, but wait a minute, I have just falsified global warming. I have shown that it's cooling in, you know, X region or Y region. And I can say, I just falsified Ronald Reagan's victory in 1984 because he didn't win Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. We're talking about science is not based upon exceptions. It's based upon preponderance of evidence. The preponderance of evidence that it's warming is overwhelming, and there are some exceptional places, as you'd expect. Just as I said, that 95% of glaciers are melting. Do the 5% that aren't say that, oh no, I falsified that the glaciers are melting? Of course not. But there are people who actually make those claims and they even get published, and the claims are scientifically ridiculous.
Okay, I've heard it, you know, described that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, then that the Earth is kind of getting like a sunburn. In other words, it gets all this heat, and we're just now starting to see the effects of it. Do you subscribe to that train of thought?
Well, I don't quite know what you mean. Sun does change its energy, but it doesn't change it by very much, and it goes up and it goes down. And there were periods when the sunspots and the energy, the extra energy associated with that was correlated with temperature, and there are periods when it was not correlated with temperature. And most people who look at that problem, and it's been studied very carefully, by the scientific community feel that the claims made by those that the sun is responsible are just simply false, because the evidence is very weak, it's speculative and assertive, and as I said earlier, if the sun did it, why didn't the stratosphere warm along with the lower atmosphere? And that's not been answered by that group. Some say, oh no, it's not the total energy from the sun, it's cosmic rays and the magnetic fields do it, and they have this elaborate theory, something like the celestial spheres before Galileo got the telescope out, you know, and show that in case, and where there's this long chain of logic where the change in the magnetic field affects the particles from the sun, which then affects a cascade of chemistry which amplifies by a factor of 100 by changing the clouds. Well, that's all very nice. It's even possible. But there is zero evidence to suggest it's happening, because if that were the case, then you'd be able to measure a change in the clouds that would create enough energy to explain the observed warmings, and there's no such evidence. So again, the community does not ignore these critics. The community looks at it very carefully. What they're doing is ignoring why they are being discounted, which is that their evidence is very weak. And that often leads to that. Now, what about dust and smoke? That's part of your question. I don't know if you call it a sunburn, but I began my career in 1970. And we didn't know warming from cooling in 1970. In fact, as a grad student, I worked for a guy at NASA, and we put dust from human pollution, you know, burning coal, oil, and gas with sulfur. Gas doesn't have sulfur, but the others do. And that makes hazes, the industrial smogs, and they make the world brighter, therefore they cool the planet. Well, we didn't know whether that won over carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas that heats the planet. So we did a calculation, and we assumed that the dust and smoke were everywhere in the world, and that carbon dioxide was the only greenhouse gas, and we concluded it was going to get cooler. And of course, lots of colleagues yelled and screamed, and they were right. But nobody really knew. So what happened in the next 3 years, in 1970 to 73, is that the community got together and figured out that the problem with that calculation was that the assumption that the human pollution, the hazes, was all around the globe was wrong, that it was largely concentrated in the industrial areas and where we burn biomass. So maybe a fifth of the world was covered with these hazes. But the CO2, the greenhouse gas, within 1 year, it spreads globally. So we overestimated the cooling by about a factor of four by assuming that the dust was global. Then, by 1974, we discovered that methane and nitrous oxide and chlorofluorocarbons were also greenhouse gases. So we found out there were more greenhouse gases. They were all global, and the dust was much more regional. And by 1974, the community was pretty well convinced that human effects would be warming more than cooling. So that's been sort of the evolution of this. I just finished writing a book that'll be out for the National Geographic Society this fall, called Science as a Contact Sport, because my life has been so combative arguing with people about these things. I try to, you know, have fun with everything, even unpleasant subjects like this. And I give the long history of this, including why I was wrong, and that, in fact, I am super proud of it, because in science, you don't mind getting the wrong answer as long as it's for the right reasons. That is, the answer we gave you fit the assumptions. But then what scientists do is they keep re-questioning their assumptions, and as we re-questioned the assumptions, it became clear that the answer was wrong, and I was glad that I was the first guy to publish what was wrong with my earlier study, not the critics, me. So, you know, we're very happy when that happens. You know, if we make an initial diagnosis, like any good doc who then runs the tests, and then the tests say, no, you were wrong, you don't stay with the original diagnosis, that'd be, you know, politically consistent. However, it's been consistently warm in the predictions since about 1974 and 75, and nobody is arguing that nature is not a piece of this, but what we're arguing is that nature's dominant role started to disappear around 1960, 1970, in the last 40 years or so, human activities have really taken over as the massive number of people in the world and our improved standard of living and our using cheap and dirty energy to get there is driving the system.
Okay, so the Earth is warming, and man is the cause. Those are the conclusions.
Warming, Colonel. The recent warming.
The recent warming. Okay.
I would never claim anything back before about 1970. That was probably a mix of both.
Okay, so you wouldn't go back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution of the 1880s.
Well, I think we had a hand in that. But it's impossible based on data to separate out the relative components of humans and nature, because there were three causes of climate change. One is just natural variability. That is, nothing is changing in terms of forcing the system. It just, the energy exchanges between the big reservoirs, the atmosphere and the oceans and the glaciers, you know, and the trees, the ecosystems, that can cause fluctuations on the order of a few tenths of a degree warming from decade to decade, and has been doing that for time immemorial. You know, and there are natural processes which make much larger changes, like ice ages and interglacial cycles, and that has to do with changes in the orbital elements of the Earth around the Sun that are due to the tug of gravity from Jupiter and Saturn on our planet, which makes, you know, how the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn are at 23 and what is it, a quarter? Well, that's not true. 9,000 years ago, it was 24 and a quarter. The map had to be redrawn. That meant a whole different pattern of sun. So the very long term, the thousands, you know, to hundreds of thousands of years, those were all naturally driven, and those were driven by energy changes in the sun, and then there were so-called feedbacks, which changed carbon dioxide and methane. But in the recent times, when the sun is, the orbit is stable, by recent, I mean in the last millennium or two, nature was dominant in terms of changing the sun a little and volcanic eruptions, that kind of thing, causing a few tenths of a degree change over time, and that has been going on and will continue to go on. We don't make El Niños and we don't make hurricanes, but we can change the intensity by warming the oceans from the greenhouse gases. So it's going to be a combination of both us and nature, but as our footprint gets bigger and bigger, we become increasingly powerful. And that's basically the story that you'll get from the scientific community.
So there you have it. Great information on how our scientists work and predict the future from the late, great Stephen Snyder, recorded in the summer of 2009, about a year before he died of a heart attack, and we sure miss him. He became a very, very good friend and, of course, an advisor to presidents all the way back to Richard Nixon. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Be mindful of where we are in today's world. If I had a word of wisdom to people today, it's the old adage of, you know, don't put anything out there on social media that you don't want to see on the front page of the newspaper. I'm Peter Forster. I'm the Associate Dean for Professional and Online Education at Penn State's College of Information Sciences and Technology.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.